I want you to take your Bibles out and turn to the book of Exodus, chapter number 14. We're going to talk this morning and this evening about a question: going on or going back? But before we address this question, we need to set the background for what is happening in Exodus chapter 14. In the beginning of time, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 1 and 2, we have the creation of the world. It was created in 6 literal days. On the 6th day of that creation, God made man. And according to verse 26 of that account, God made man in His own image. And God made man the pinnacle of His creation. He was one that was created with an inner being, with an inner character, a soul, that made Him different than all of other God's creation. He also was the only one created to have fellowship with His Creator. He made it so that man could fellowship and have fellowship with God. That lasted until Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, the serpent tempted Eve and told her that she could be like God, that she would know good from evil. And he told her a partial truth. If she did eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, she would have a knowledge of good and evil, and in that way she would be like God. But he did not tell her fully what the consequences of that decision would be. God had told Adam and Eve in Genesis 2:16 to 17 that if you eat of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, in the day that you eat it, you will die. You will die. Now, I'm sure God, Adam and Eve did not understand all that meant. But God assured them that would happen. And when they did eat of that tree, and God came in the garden in the cool of the day, and they said they hid themselves because they were naked, then they had already revealed they did what God told them not to do. Because God's first question is, who has told thee that thou was naked? Have you eaten of the tree that I commanded you not? And you remember what Adam did. He first of all blamed Eve, but in essence he blamed God, because God was the one that took Eve, made him from the rib of Adam, and gave him to Adam. And in essence he was blaming God for giving him the woman. And the woman blamed the serpent because he deceived her and lied to her. And then the serpent, of course, did his work because he was contrary to all things that are good. But if you remember in the account in Genesis 3, that all three were punished. The serpent was punished, the man was punished, and the woman was punished. And in verse 24, God kept his promise. And the promise was that man would be driven from the presence of God, that he would die. That death was a spiritual death. That was a separation between God and man. And what that did is that set in motion a plan that God had made before time began. And that was how he was going to bring reconciliation between sinful man and God the Creator again after the advent of sin. Now, many things had to take place in order for this to take place. The plan begins in Genesis 12. To a man named Abraham. Abraham, the great patriarch, was called by God to leave his homeland. And when he was called to leave, God made three special promises to Abraham. Number one, from his seed he would make a mighty nation. That nation would also get a land that would be their own, that they would be able to call home. But the third promise, and the most significant promise, was the promise of, through his seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. That is the spiritual seed promise that would see its inevitable fulfillment in the Son of God Himself, in Jesus Christ, and we can read that in Galatians chapter 11. But before we ever get to Christ, we have to get to the nation. We have to get to the nation because the nation is the means that God's going to bring His Son out of that nation. And so beginning in Genesis 12, after he leaves his homeland, we have the story of Joseph in Genesis chapter 37 through 50. And in that story, the son of Jacob, one of his sons, one of the 12 sons, He is taken into, he is sold into bondage by his brother. And he ends up in Egypt in Potiphar's house. After spending some time in jail for a false accusation, 2 years as a matter of fact in prison, he is brought out because he has the ability to understand dreams. And Pharaoh had a dream and Joseph had the answer. And so Joseph gave answer to Pharaoh. Pharaoh made him second in command of all Egypt, and part of his revelation was there was going to be 7 years of famine throughout the whole land where there would be a great dearth throughout all the earth. And it came to pass. But because of the wisdom of Joseph and because of God, they had made storehouses in Egypt so they would be protected when the famine came. But then all the nations of the world would have to come to Egypt to get grain. That meant there was going to be a reunion between Joseph and his brothers. And they came to Egypt in Genesis chapter number 45. And when they come into Egypt to get grain, sent by their father, who did not send Benjamin because he had already lost Joseph and he didn't want to lose this youngest son, they came and they did not recognize Joseph, but Joseph recognized them. And so what they did was that Joseph tested them. And then through passage of time, he reveals himself to those brothers and he convinces them that he means good for them and not ill. And then he tells him to go get his father and his younger brother and bring him back to Egypt and he will take care of them there that they might be protected from the famine. And indeed he does. They do. They go back and they bring their father back and he is so joyous that he has now found that Joseph not only alive, but he's in a powerful position. He finds out there's a way that he can save his family from starvation. And they take up a home in a place called Goshen. And then Abraham dies, Joseph dies, and that brings us to the book of Exodus. And as we are in the book of Exodus, that takes us to what we're going to talk about. What happened while they were in Egypt? While Joseph lived, everything went very well for them. But when Joseph died, the Bible says that there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And what was happening in Egypt is God was keeping his first promise. The Israelite people were multiplying by great numbers. That caught the attention of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh began to worry that these people were so numerous that they could join his enemies and they could be a problem. And so he determined in the Exodus chapter 1 that he is going to make them slaves to him, to build things for him and to serve him. And so he makes them servants and slaves in Egypt. And their slavery is very difficult. It is very hard and they are greatly oppressed. And that being so, they cry to God for deliverance. They cried to God to remember the promises that he had made to Abraham. Well, God had not forgotten. God had intended to keep his promises made to Abraham. And so in Exodus chapter 3, we have the introduction of another great Bible hero, a man named Moses. Moses is chosen by God to be the deliverer, to bring God's people out of Egypt, a free nation, a free people, and a people that would be able to be one of his own choosing. But Moses was not very jumping up and down about the ideal. He thought God chose the wrong person. He wasn't eloquent. He was slow of tongue. He was a nobody. They're not going to listen to me. And every excuse he gave in Exodus chapter 3 and 4, God gave an answer to. The last thing that he said, that God gave him a spokesperson, and that was his brother Aaron. And they were to go with Pharaoh, and their message to Pharaoh was very short and very to the point. God says to let his people go, that they may go out in the wilderness, that they may offer offering and sacrifice to me. And you remember in Exodus chapter 5, he comes before Pharaoh, Moses, and Aaron, and he makes the request. And I want you to take your Bibles and I want you to look at the answer that Pharaoh gave in Exodus chapter 5 and verse number 2. Exodus 5 and verse number 2. It's probably one of the greatest understatements that has ever been made in biblical history. And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go." But you know what? This should not have come as a surprise to Moses, because God told Moses that he's going to be stubborn, that he's not going to relent, that he's going to be unwilling to release my people. And so I'm going to have to demonstrate my power unto Pharaoh and to Egypt and to the world. And in the process, demonstrate his power to these children of Israel. Now it begins with the plague of blood. And it goes through a number of different plagues. Beginning with the plague of insects and flies, God made a distinction between the Israelites and the Egyptians. In the land of Goshen, the land that was given to Abraham and his descendants, in the land where the Israelites lived, beginning with the plague of the flies, all the plagues went to Egypt, but in that little land of Goshen, there was not any plague that hindered those people. Not the flies, not the locusts, not the darkness, none of those things came upon the Israelites, they just came upon the Egyptians. God was showing, not only was he powerful, he could direct his power to any that he chose. Now, two things should have happened because of this. Number one, it should have woke Pharaoh up that he's dealing with someone that is greater than himself. It should have got him to see that there was one greater in the throne than him, and it was the God of all the earth. Number two, it should have strengthened the understanding of the people of God that their God was fighting for them, that their God was greater than Pharaoh, and that their God would deliver them and keep his promises, and it should have gave them great confidence and assurance that God heard their prayer and God was answering their request. That's what it should have done. It did neither. First of all, it didn't help Pharaoh. He would relent. He would bring Moses and Aaron in. And then he said, "I'm sorry," and tell God to make the things go away. And then he tried to negotiate the process. He said, "Well, you can go, but leave your animals here." "Well, you can't do that. You've got to offer the animals for sacrificing." Then he said, "Well, you can take the animals, but leave your children and your wives." He said, "No, we can't do that either." And then he tried to get him to go, and then to leave some of their goods. He says, "No, we're not going to do that." And so it became frustration to Pharaoh, but the people around Pharaoh understood what was happening. They said, "This man, the Egypt is being destroyed before you. Let him go. Let him go. All of Egypt is falling, and you're being stubborn. Let them go. You're fighting against God." But he would not relent. And so God brought a final plague, the worst of all of them. And that was the death of the firstborn. Every child in Egypt, from Pharaoh to the lowest servant, to all the cattle that were left in the land, any firstborn was going to die in a night when God would send the messenger or the destroyer through Egypt that night. But in Exodus chapter 12, God instituted something that is very important to what we're talking about, and that is the Passover. God instituted a means of Israel being spared the death of the firstborn. He gave them very strict instructions that they were to take a lamb according to the number of people in their household. They were to do certain things with it at twilight. Then they were to kill it. And then they were to eat all of the meat before dawn, and they were to take some of the blood and they were to put it on the lintels or the doorpost of their house. And when the angel of death came through at that night into Egypt, he would see the blood and he would pass over them. Now, you know what they did? They did exactly what God commanded them to do. The destroyer came into Egypt, and there came a cry in Egypt that has never been heard since then. There was death everywhere. And Pharaoh was so scared, and the people around, he said, "Get out. Get out right now." And they took anything they needed. They were gladly given it because the people were worried that they were all going to die, and they just wanted them out. And so they leave Egypt in the middle of the night, and they plunder them, and they have every necessity that they need for the journey. Now they're on their way. And where are they on their way to? They're on their way to the promised land. To the land that God promised Abraham for the nation that grew in oppression. And now God is fulfilling His promises. But the Exodus is an outstanding event, but there are some problems. You see, it started by faith, but it didn't end in faith. You see, they were delivered by the Lord. They came to the Red Sea. And when they came to the Red Sea, there was an obstacle. There was an obstacle to their retreat, to their freedom. And when they came to the Red Sea in Exodus chapter number 14, they also could see behind them that Pharaoh had changed his mind. And he had pursued them with an army of chariots. And he was going to bring them back to Egypt. And they could see him, but God kept a pillar of fire and a cloud that kept a separation between the two. But they could see them, and they were greatly afraid. Now, how many of them were there? Well, in Numbers chapter 1 and verse 46 and 47, we know that the men of war, that was all those 20 and over, numbered over 500,000, approximately 603,000. 550. But that wasn't counting the Levites, and that wasn't counting men and children and those who were not men of war and the wives. And so there have been conservative estimates that the nation of Israel could have been between 2 and 3 million people at this time. Well, now, brethren, that's a lot of people. 2 or 3 million people, and they're being pursued by 600 chariots. And there's 603 of them who are of the man of war, who are of the age of war. Now, the Red Sea was a problem. Now, what were they going to do? In Exodus chapter 14, I want you to take your Bibles and I want you to see what they thought they were going to do. What was their first plan? Look at verse 11. Then they said to Moses, "It is because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness. Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." You know what? I went back and I read the first 13 chapters of Exodus, and I never found that they told God to leave them alone and leave them in Egypt. All I find is crying, pleading, and anguish for deliverance. That's what I read. Now, they did get discouraged when Moses first went, and he made their task greater, but after the plague, there is not one word that they wanted. They did not want deliverance. Why did they want to remain in Egypt? Here's why. In verse number 10. "As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they became very frightened, and so the sons of Israel cried to the Lord." Now, ladies and gentlemen, these are a fickle people. They wanted deliverance. They got it. Now, I wanted you to ask you a simple question. What had they just witnessed in Egypt. What had they seen with their own eyes? They saw the plagues. They saw the devastation. They saw Egypt destroyed right before their eyes. And then they saw God make distinction between them and the Egyptians. And then they saw the death of the firstborn, but yet they saw their children protected, and they saw their children delivered, and they saw all of that. But brethren, it did not make an impression. You know why? Because they had short memories. They had short memories. But I want you to notice, Moses' understanding is much better. Look at verse 13. But Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." What does that mean? You know what that means? It means shut up. Stand there and watch and see that God is going to deliver you. And that night, Moses prayed. And that night, God sent an east wind that blew upon the waters of the Red Sea. And it blew all night. And in the morning, there was a dry path between the Red Sea with walls of water on the right and on the left, and in the middle, there was dry ground. That was God's means of escape in order for them to go to freedom. All they had to do is take a step of faith and go across. And they did. And once they got across on the other side, then Pharaoh made his last fatal mistake. He was so enraged, he was so blinded by his rage and his arrogance and his haughtiness that he went into the Red Sea after them. And when he got somewhere in there, I don't know how far he got, but he got in there a ways, and then wheels of their chariots became stuck in the mud. And all of a sudden, it didn't go on for Pharaoh, but it did for the rest of them. We're fighting God. We better get out of here. And so they started to run. You know what? When I was a little boy and I saw the Ten Commandments, I thought that was the greatest spectacle I had ever seen on the screen, when Moses, who was Charlton Heston in this movie, brings that rod up and those waters just come together. And I thought that was so magnificent. And then about 25 years later, I went to Universal Studios where they did that. And they had it there where you could see it. I was really depressed. It was terrible. But it looked great on the screen. But you know what? I have always remembered, what would that do to your faith? If you were an Israelite, you're on dry ground, and here's your enemies, and here's God closing the water in. And you look on the shore, and they're dead. You know what you are? You are a free people. You are a free nation. God has kept His first promise. You have your freedom. In Exodus chapter 15, it's called the Song of Moses. They were so happy. They were so grateful. And they were so high. We would call this, they were on the highest high they've ever been on. Here they are, a free people, free from depression, free from slavery, their own nation, God's their leader, and they're on the way to the promised land. What a beginning. But it was not to be. Because, you see, it ended in victory, but 40 years later, not 40 years before. For 40 years, it took 40 years to pass the Jordan. Man, how would it take 40 years to pass the Jordan? They were right at the banks of Jordan. They were at the borders of Canaan. Why did it take 40 years? Because they did not believe God. Because they did not believe His power. They did not believe His promise, and they did not believe that He would take care of them. In Exodus chapter 16, they begin to murmur. And they begin to murmur because they have no water. God did all that in Egypt. He parted the Red Sea. He killed your enemies, and you think water's a problem for God? And they begin to murmur. And so what you see is, but in between, the people were much discouraged because of the way, and many fell. What did it mean? What did the writer Moses mean that they were discouraged because of the way? What does that mean? That means the means that God was delivering them, they didn't like. They wanted deliverance in another way. And so the Exodus is an outstanding world event, but many men were discouraged. And they were discouraged because it was not easy. The journey was not going to be easy from the very beginning, but God would see them through if they would be faithful. It was not the shortest route to Canaan. The route that they were taking were not, it wasn't the shortest route, but the reason He chose the route that He did is because of their fickleness. He didn't want them to run into any problems, because He knew if they did, that they would become weak, and they would become discouraged, and then they would murmur. God knew that. Why did He know that? Because He knew the hearts of all men. He knew His people. He knew what they would do. Now perhaps they could not see the reason God required so many things. They couldn't understand why God did things in His way. They couldn't understand that. And so that made the way more difficult. And then they were filled with doubts and misgivings about the new way. They were unsure. They weren't really convinced. And they always had these problems. And they would be set by these problems because they trusted themselves more than they trusted God. And one other thing. They longed for the good old days. I want you to turn to Numbers chapter 11. Look at verse 4. And the rabble who was among them had greedy desires. And also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, and the cucumbers, and the melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone, and there's nothing to look at except this manna." You know what they said? "We don't like your diet. We want what we used to have. We want what it was before, because it was better." Was it better? Even if they had all that food, was it better? They were in oppression. They were in bondage. They did not have their freedom. And their children and their wives and their homes were not theirs. They belonged to another nation. How was it better? I don't care how much food they had. How was it better? You know why it was better? Because it wasn't what they had now. You know what that is? That's what we call a here and now person. A person that just lives at the moment and forgets about how things really were. But you remember these passages in the New Testament? Those things written aforetime were written for our learning. Turn also to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and look at verse 1 and 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1 and 2. "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and passed through the sea and were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." In other words, that we should learn some lessons from what happened in Egypt. Now, The question before us is to go on or to go back. That was the question that faced Israel, and they chose the wrong thing. And because of their choice, 603,550 died in the wilderness during a 40-year trek that God caused them to go on to kill the first generation that rejected God's care and His promise and gave it to the second generation and demonstrated that He would still fulfill His promise. But they said, we want to be back in Egypt. You're not going back to Egypt, but you're not going to the promised land either. You said that I brought your children out here to kill them. No, in Numbers chapter 14, I'm not going to kill your children, but I'm going to give you what you wanted. You didn't want the land. You're not going in. And they didn't. And so what lessons can you and I learn about going on or going back? Ladies and gentlemen, there are a lot of people in the Lord's church that live in the past, that live on the memory of how things used to be, and live about how their life used to be before they became a Christian, and about all the good things that they had and all the good things they could do, and they have failed to understand what they have in Christ, and really, the good old days weren't as good as you think they were. And what lessons can we learn? That's what this lesson is all about. What can we learn? How can we answer this question in our time? To go on or to go back? Ladies and gentlemen, in our day, many are going back. In our day, many who have started down the road that leads to life, the path that leads to life, the straight narrow path, that few there be that find it, many of our brethren are going back. Why are they going back? Because they forget. And because they don't appreciate what they have now. And so they had obstacles that they had to get around. And we've got to get around them too. Number one, the first obstacle they had was their escape. Their escape was planned by God. Pharaoh pursued them, that's true. But Pharaoh could not harm them as long as they stuck with God. Yes, the enemy was behind them. The enemy was very formidable, but they could not overtake God. Did Pharaoh have any luck dealing with God in Exodus chapter 5 through 12? Did he have any success at all? Did he have any success to stand against God as he brought the plagues one after another? Did Pharaoh have any success? Not any. Did he have any success when they got across the sea? No. He didn't have any. So who could be greater than God? If God's with you, what can anybody do against you? The people were very afraid. You know why they were very afraid? By what they saw. But they lost their faith. Their faith was what they saw, not with what they could not see. The Lord provided salvation for the people. He made it possible. They witnessed it. They were delivered. So He overcame the first obstacle, and that was the enemy. The enemy was defeated. Now what about us? What lessons can we learn from that? Number one, Satan has a purpose in our life. Our enemy is Satan. And his desire has never changed from the beginning. What he did to Adam and Eve is what he wants to do to you. And that is, he wants to destroy your relationship with God. He wants to destroy you that you'll be with him in eternity in hell. That's his purpose, that's his aim, and he's very good at what he does. And 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 says he's a roaring lion seeking whom he devour. And you know who? You know, I've learned a little bit about a lion. You know, the lion's the king of the beast, but he's also very smart. And you know what he does when he prays? He crouches and he waits. But you know who he goes after? He goes after the maimed, the sick, the weak. And that's exactly what Satan does. You get discouraged. You get disillusioned. You're unhappy. You don't like the way things are going. Satan's got an antidote for you. Satan got someone that you can just point a finger and you can blame and you can wallow and you can blame everybody or you can fight against him. You see, radical change is not always easy. Nobody said it. God didn't say it'd be easy. God didn't say it'd be easy to get to the promised land. And he didn't say there wouldn't be any obstacles. And ladies and gentlemen, God didn't say that it would be easy for us to get to heaven. Because it's not going to be. Because Satan's going to fight you tooth and nail. The world is going to try to discourage you. It's going to try to influence you to go the wrong way. And the devil is never going to relent to the day that you die. But he can't beat you. He can't destroy you. He can't win. This is a battle that the devil can't win. The only way the devil wins in my life is if I let him in. There's no other way he can win. He's not greater than God. He's not smarter than God. And he's not going to outdo God. And he has no greater, he has power that is much less than God's. But that doesn't mean that he's not formidable. That doesn't mean that he can't wreak havoc. And that doesn't mean that he can't make it difficult. He can do all of that. But he cannot destroy you. The obstacle is our faith. That's our obstacle. The Lord has provided salvation. Salvation has appeared to all men. And what does the grace that appears to all men, what does it teach us? To deny ungodliness and worldly lust. To live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. And when you do that, the devil can't get around that. He can't do a thing about that. He can't win when you do that. He can't overcome you when you do that. And he cannot master you when you do that. And see, the first obstacle that Israel faced is their own faith. Their own faith in understanding those ways and reasons why God does what he does. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I understand why God has everything the way he does, because I don't. I'll give you two very good examples. I don't understand why God continues to let the world turn. I don't understand that. With their hatred for God, our country is trying to take God out of everything. Out of schools, out of our money, out of our thinking. Why does God put up with it? Why does God tolerate it? I don't understand that. Why doesn't God swiftly punish evil men? Why does God let men who do nothing but cause havoc upon this world and everybody around them, why does God let them live? I don't have an answer to that. You know why? Because I'm not God. But you know what I do know? I do know there's a reason. I do know that they cannot defeat me. They cannot steal my crown, and they cannot take me away from the Lord unless I let them. Anything that Egypt would do, and anything that the enemies of God would do, they could not overcome Israel as long as her faith was in who? God, and in not themselves. So the first obstacle many times in our life is how strong our faith is. You know, I learned a long time ago, I remember a lesson that I heard many years ago in Florida by Connie Ammons. And he gave this lesson, which was very touching to me, after the death of his first wife. I think it might have been 4 months after the death of his first wife. And he was talking about the challenges of suffering. And he was talking about the difficulties facing us in life and the struggles that we come in contact with. And you know, he made this profound statement that I have never forgotten. Matter of fact, I made a lesson on it. I was so struck by what he said. He said, the question is not, where is God when I suffer, when I struggle, when I have difficulty? The question is not, where is God? The question is, where am I? Where is my faith? Where is my trust? Where is my confidence? And that's a true statement. It's always about where we're at, not where God's at. God provided freedom. He made them a nation. He gave them their freedom. He released them from bondage. He released them from oppression. He destroyed their enemies. They had everything. They were at the borders of Canaan. The spies went in. And it showed that it was exactly like God said, but the people feared what they saw instead of trusting and placing their confidence in God. Ladies and gentlemen, they made a tragic choice, and it cost them their lives. What about us? What about the things that we must struggle with? If you're here today and you're not a child of God, then you're fighting the devil on his terms, in his backyard, and you're playing by his rules. And as long as you do that, the devil has the advantage in your life. The obstacle in your life is your lack of faith in God. Faith in God is a must. That's why the Hebrew writer said, without faith it's impossible to please him. We must have faith. Trust, confidence, unwavering allegiance that God's way is the best way. Hearing the Word of God, believing it, repenting of your sin, confessing His name before man, and being subject to the watery grave of baptism, the contact of the blood of Christ. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot of people that don't understand it. But I'm going to tell you, it works just like going across the Red Sea on dry land. And you know why it worked then? And you know why it works now? Because God's providing the way. And when you go with God, you can't lose. You can't lose when you do it God's way. If you're here and you're a child of God and you've wandered back into the world and you've lost your focus, you've lost your sight, you just need to get back to where you need to be. And that is to trust in God fully. He didn't say that He'll take all your problems away, but He'll give you enough faith and courage and strength that they cannot destroy you if you'll trust Him, if you'll follow His lead and not your own. That's what Simon was told to do. And he asked Peter in Acts 8, verse 24, please, pray to the Lord for me that none of these things will come upon you. If we can help you this morning in any way to make your life right with God, we bid you to come forward as together we stand, as we sing.